Today's video is brought to you by Audible. Audible provides an easily accessible way to access audiobooks for its members, just one of the reasons why I recommend it, along with enabling you to make huge savings on the newest full-length Warhammer audiobooks. I know that many people listen to audiobooks just as they do YouTube while painting miniatures, but also commuting or doing other daily tasks. A question I've often heard people pose in recent weeks has been, how do you get over the hump or lull of Warhammer enthusiasm? Finding something to reignite or spark your interest can be tough. Well, for me, the way to get over that hump is lore. It could be giving the classic Heresy series another listen, or perhaps a favourite short. For myself of late, it's been the Warhammer Crime series, and I greatly hope they continue turning out more of these, because if nothing else, I find the series a great refresher and a breakaway from the galactic tales of orcs and space marines. Plus, if you want to find the real grim dark, it's not in the battles of glory among the stars, it's down in the filth and claustrophobic decay of hive cities. I'll explain my choice of selection for today at the end of this video. As an Audible Premium member, you'll receive one credit every month for use on any title, and a great many of you who I hear from so regularly are already using Audible. If you're still to try it out, well, you can start today with a free 30-day Audible trial to get yourself full access to thousands of audiobooks, originals, and podcasts that are additionally included in the Plus catalogue. Just visit audible.com/Lutin, and for those in the US, you can also text Lutin to 500-500. In the grim darkness of the far future, there is only war. War, so simple a word yet so complex and devastating for the horror it wreaks upon those who simply were trying to live out their existence as best they could. In the darkness of M41, there are many worlds of humanity who thought themselves untouched by the grim milestone of being engaged by a blinkered, ignorant oppressor, only to find that suddenly the wolves are at their door, and the only thing able to save them is the might of the Imperium. That is to say, if the might of the Imperium comes. For despite the tales of glory, the living memories told and retold by veterans and civilians alike, very often these are more representative of mere moments in time, and though the glory of the victory is kept alive, the sacrifice remembered, few wish to face the horror again, dare they risk the spectre of defeat that hangs over them. Very often though, war is insidious, it creeps and spreads and infects neighbouring planets, systems and sectors, it bleeds through Imperial territory, to tolerate the loss of one world is to invite the collapse of all. This is why the Imperium fights bitterly over worlds that may often seem superficially unimportant, that were previously barely thought of, yet when the inevitable creep of the Xenos appears on their borders, insignificant worlds become crucibles of war. The battle for the war zone known as Octarius is in essence the typical tide of war that the Imperium tirelessly attempts to repel. The ravenous monsters of the void continually lap and scratch and claw at Imperial territory, yet where ordinarily this might involve only a few worlds, Octarius scales up such border incursions from a mere system to an entire sector. Inquisitor Krippmann was the visionary who orchestrated the white-hot crucible that is the Octarian war zone, which now involves not only the Tyranid against the Orc Xenos, but also has entangled multiple sub-factions of the Imperium, the Eldari and even Chaos have come to gorge themselves upon the impossible levels of destruction, the multi-system meat grinder. Octarius, though, did not become a self-contained war of attrition between the Tyranid and Orc, it snowballed and now risks spiralling out as the tendrils of its gargantuan conflict absorb ever more systems of Imperial territory. To this end, the Imperium has attempted to now actively contain the situation through the means of its so-called Cordon Impenetra, devised by Inquisitor Sahansun, an optimistic effort that attempts to contain this situation with a surgical strike offensive approach, targeting areas of critical Xenos mass and effectively lancing them before they can burst out all over another Imperial system like so many festering Nurgle boils. A fairly left-of-field approach to seemingly release the pressure. The most difficult question would be, of course, would this so-called impenetrable cordon be up to the task? Would the line be held? Despite the ever-present tales of glorious success throughout the Imperium, I've often wondered how many times this rhetoric has led Imperial worlds to be caught off guard when the enemies of humanity come crashing down upon them and the reinforcements which are subsequently nowhere to be seen. The mission-critical Pancalis subsector, which lay upon the edge of this cordon, had been, like so many others, holding, but barely. Inquisitor Sahansun and others were painfully aware that defeat here would likely trigger the entire cordon project to collapse before it were able to be reinforced and shored up for the longer defensive mission they were planning for. Should any Xenos successfully break the cordon, the consequences would be severe, and very likely, given the available resources, irreversible. Yet despite continual and repeated orders for supplies, materials were not arriving. Necessary hardware and reinforcements to bolster the many worlds that had been, even from the outset, assessed as being below the necessary defensive strength. Some worlds had managed to stockpile resources, others had been stripped for use flexibly, where other areas of the cordon were being tested, and so perhaps unwittingly, the humans of M41 mirrored some of the most brutal and devastating conflicts of the 20th century, where along the perimeter of the cordon, worlds that had appeared strong were in fact paper thin and barely able to stand against any assault. Realistically, it was not a matter of if the cordon impenetra would face a true test of Imperial resolve, it was of course merely a matter of when. As the Eldari might consider, if the strands of fate could be woven for an optimal outcome, then they still might hold. If not, then the only realistic alternative would likely manifest. That of total catastrophe. The Forge World of Sigma Ulstari was one of the few worlds granted clemency by Sahansun. While countless other worlds were deemed too costly or too irrelevant to the security of the cordon, to the point they were abandoned without restraint, thankfully for Sigma Ulstari, it was both a Forge world and a world which had already weathered its fair share of repelling Xenos due to its proximity to the Octarius Empire of the Orcs. So for Sahansun, although the Forge world was somewhat on the periphery of the cordon, it made sense to grant it the status of being a world included in the defensive cordon, thereby not alienating the Mechanicus of the world and allowing the Inquisitor access to its resources. Saying this though, much of its current production and neighbouring Factorum worlds were already outputting maximum effort into merely arming and bolstering their own defences. Their populations though were massive, as were their defensive networks, system monitors in the form of huge asteroids outfitted with hardware to rival Imperial battleships. The Forge World would vastly increase now its output of Skitarii for the oncoming onslaught and distribute them about its system, as well as construction of more heavy fortresses. More critically though, Sigma Ulstari was uniquely positioned to act as a relay point for communications, and this was vital to the plan of Inquisitor Sahansun, who wanted to know the movements and power of Xenos forces, that they might specifically target their enemy and cripple them with precision. Their numbers simply did not allow for a more typical blunt force approach that was often the trademark of the Imperium. Because of this critical role, Ulstari had been granted additional astropaths, ships, as well as Sororitas and even Imperial Knights. The strength of the Sigma Ulstari system had become unsurprisingly a beacon to so many of the worlds that likely unbeknownst to themselves had been already fully abandoned by the Imperium. For whatever reason, some clearly saw the writing on the wall and decided to flee, and many would now arrive at Sigma Ulstari. Much to the annoyance, of course, for the Mechanicus, who found the unwashed masses to be of great annoyance and disruption for their preparations in defending the system, and continuing their communication relays for Inquisitor Sahansun. These civilian refugee fleets would be distributed among various system worlds, but were generally left to administrators to handle the details of. Some who were left aboard ships became disorderly to the point of rioting, and such situations were quickly put down with brutal Imperial efficiency. Malnutrition and starvation were other common causes for a miserable end to those who had looked to the Imperium, to the Emperor, and found it lacking. Many who had fled the annihilation of their worlds would of course be categorized and assessed for work details by the Mechanicus, who would then distribute them for work in mining, Factorum Industrial or PDF forces. Any who were assessed but did not meet standards were commonly noted as having disappeared. Their fate unknown, but as with most Forge worlds, we might speculate the most likely scenario for such poor souls is either that of a tech thrall or servitor. However you want to slice it, this means essentially a state of living death. And quite honestly, the resolution for people looking simply to escape the horrors of Xenos invasion, the fact that their fates are so bleak, really hammers home the dystopian nightmare that is the Imperium. One of the worlds within the Ulstari system, Deuteria, which I shall refrain from making references to bolter ammunition and water, oh I just did, here was where the Xenos form of the Tyranid would first rain down upon the Sigma Ulstari system. Now, like many other ocean worlds before it, the seas were soon boiling over with hostile lifeforms, accompanied by vast flocks of winged forms that eclipsed their star. The battles which unfolded were bizarre by any standards of the 41st millennium. Floating townships were the main habitation areas of Deuteria, which cast deep anchor pillars below them. Many of these came under heavy assault from the Tyranid forces, but thanks to rapid repair systems, they were able to maintain their defences and figuratively keep their heads above water. Upon this world, more nomadic fleets of ships would travel the planet together, and these became large hunting parties who would focus on tracking and eliminating the Xenos wherever they were found. No simple thing though, and casualties were very high here. Ultimately, the peoples of Deuteria were victorious, baiting the Tyranids by forming together their fleet ships. The Tyranids converged largely to one area of the ocean world, and thus, due to their concentration, atomic depth charges were able to vaporize much of the Xenos. Of course, use of such weaponry was less than an ideal solution, and for those who survived in the aftermath, their future and that of their ocean world remains unknown. As is seemingly often the case when it comes to destroying Tyranid fleet tendrils, the cost of achieving this feat may well be nearly as costly in the long term as simply having been scoured by the Xenos itself. For Forge World Sigma Ulstari, it had some significant advantages from the outset, and this worked heavily to its favour in reducing the effectiveness of a Tyranid assault. For one thing, very obviously, Forge Worlds have some of the heaviest defences of Imperial Worlds, and this is only then backed up by the likes of Titans, Knights, which are commonly stationed upon them. For Sigma Ulstari, it was no exception. Titan, Legio, Ferrocastrum, and various Knight Houses were ready to unleash hell upon the Xenos, with the Tyranids facing obliteration as soon as they began to descend to the world below. For the Tyranids, this assaulting of a Forge world proved incredibly difficult. Often their vanguard lifeforms and spores were landing within oceans of the world, or at least large bodies of water. The difficulty of doing this upon a hive or Forge world is that very often oceans are commonly absent, and what appears to be oceans may in fact be outpourings of toxic waste material and other pollution. This was the case upon Sigma Ulstari, and as their initial forms were disintegrated within the hellish soup, other scouting bioforms focused descending Tyranids toward the land masses, of which there were not so many suitable for the invading Xenos. They were thin stretches of land, and it was because of this that the defenders had carefully planned their defenses, to which the Titans and other Bastion defenders began to unleash a storm of offensive fire against the enemy, shredding them and burning them from the skies. The Tyranids are of course though suffocating, and if their only means of victory is to literally clog the enemy weapons with their dead, they will do so, and have literally used this tactic when invading other Imperial worlds' ground defences. Because of the nature of the Tyranids, the onslaught was relentless. Many defensive systems were operating at maximum capacity, often firing for hour upon hour upon hour without any respite. Were it not for the difficulty of the world's terrain and its suitability for a vast Tyranid force attempting to descend, the sheer numbers spread across the world would likely have caused a far more severe outcome. Thankfully, combat was constrained to the Forge spires. Radiation scoured desert wastelands and the planetary orbit of the world itself. Casualties upon the planet were still high, but the defenders held the line. Production, though, was crippled, with many forge vanes and spires, in many cases production halting entirely. And additionally, despite their success in standing strong against the deluge, many millions of Tyranid forms still survived upon the world and were scattered now throughout the forges, and they would all still need to be purged and exterminated. Sigma Altari would need considerable time to become fully operational, efficient, and ready for their next defensive stand whenever it came. Unfortunately, that next assault would come in mere months. Within Octarius, to survive a Tyranid assault is no small thing, to be sure, but it also invites others to exploit a depleted and weakened world, and the Orcs always stand ready to do so. And so this is what would come at Sigma Altari next. Orc bosses by the names of De Butcher and De Facecrumper. They'd been harassing and running down fleeing refugee fleets, which ultimately led them to the Forge World, and which caught their attention far more acutely. While some repairs and reinforcements had been made by defenders, it was still considerably weakened by the Tyranid assault, and other planets like Mola Saxum were simultaneously assaulted by the Orc menace. The ever-determined Imperial forces would hold the line yet again, and eventually the Orcs would be repelled, in no small part due to the vast numbers of human defenders, coupled with well-planned kill zones and pre-ranged artillery bombardments, able to smash the invaders to pulp almost as they deployed. Yet a secondary victory was of little comfort for the leadership of the system. Sigma Altari had survived, but now lay even more bruised and bloodied. A third assault would inevitably come, and even the most optimistic strategists struggled to see how the battered worlds would be able to endure any more Xenos invasion attempts without significant time to reinforce, rearm, and repair their damaged systems. Worse still though, through the communications relays being monitored and reports from rogue traders who were still operating in the area, it was becoming clear that the Pancalis subsector was merely the beginning. Inquisitor Sahansun's grand plan to enclose the Octarius War was fracturing already, and maintaining it was requiring more and more reinforcements. Militarum, Sororitas, Astartes, more and more were needed every day, and fewer could be found. When the next assault came, defense seemed more of an obligation than a purpose. The Tyranids had returned, thousands of their strange bioships were powering towards Sigma Altari, and when their forms descended once again from the skies into the highly toxic oceans, observers were initially joyous. The Xenos had made an unbelievable mistake in repeating their initial error of their previous invasion. Perhaps luck and the will of the Emperor himself was on their side. Maybe they would be able to hold back a third assault. Very quickly, this hope dissipated when they saw many thousands, if not millions, of bioforms dragging themselves up out of the industrial oceans of the planet. The Tyranids had not been dissolved in the vast seas of hazardous waste. They had adapted. It had now no effect upon them. Their numbers were far greater than even the first assault. Panic immediately gripped the Imperials. Their artillery emplacements were not positioned to cover the enemy emerging from the toxic oceans. This was an eventuality that had not been calculated by the Magos. A night household and a fast-moving raid by Imperial Aeronautica bombers were deployed without any real strategy or battle plan beyond kill on sight. And it seems this was just enough to prevent a full and total collapse of the defences. Elsewhere, though, forged spires were still remaining under assault and taking heavy casualties and infrastructure damage. House Galerius, like so many knights before them, on countless now forgotten or unknown worlds, led heroic final charges into the thrashing, writhing mass of Xenos horrors, but at best they succeeded in merely slowing their advance as they were consumed in the thronging biomass of forms. But this was still nothing. Worse was to come for Sigma Altari, as we returned to our old favourite among the Xenos, the vaguely defined form of the Tunnelling Horror. Much hated by many for appearing seemingly out of nowhere and slaughtering those who had banked their security on a single strong point. In the case of the Tyranids, tunnelling is perhaps too specific. Certainly, some of their forms can just chew through rock as if it were cardboard mush. But many smaller forms merely infiltrate through pipes, ducts, and access tunnels, thought to be too small of a risk. but the result is much the same. One might say that the defenses of Sigma Austari were designed around a singular, large-scale assault, whereas singular but more deadly forms were able to penetrate outer defenses through tunnels or otherwise. The Imperium clearly did not anticipate these smaller forms as being problematic, thus the Tyranids were able to destroy and target this weakness. They were able to wreak havoc and inflict mass casualties on unwitting defenders who had expected their close-quarter encounters with Tyranids to have been a last-stand situation, not something they would face in the early openings of an invasion. Then, of course, the situation made worse by the Tyranids' habit of choking ducts and vents with their dead, potentially then leading to other issues such as air supply for underground bunker complexes. The fighting across Sigma Austari had become now so severe and extreme, so critical, that various Skitarii willingly were throwing themselves into the open jaws of Tyranid forms in attempts to slay them from within inside rather than battle against incredibly thick carapace armor. The cost for the Mechanicus was becoming far too severe, not in human terms of course, but the loss of knowledge and technology was becoming too great to bear. Transports containing innumerable data slates, Forge Spire projects, things were spiraling down exponentially and the situation had to be neutralized and balanced quickly if there was any hope of surviving this nightmare. Strange warp storms had caused beings from that hellish realm to intervene in many a conflict happening throughout the Octarius sector. This meant Tyranids suddenly found their green menace distinctly lacking and were able to be overrun and consumed by them. Likewise, many Orc war bosses were able to swing a stalled conflict in their favour and finish splattered bugs, you might say, but more on this later. For now, one Tusker Grob World Killer, that's World with a U, their battle was disappointingly over far too soon. So for him and Du Bois, they went looking for a new fight, and they soon found it at Sigma Austari. The Tyranids' reaction was one of screaming displeasure that few could imagine the sound of other than to hear it for oneself, a sound to be likely deafening and terror-inducing in equal measure. For the Tyranids had not expected to find any other foe in this invasion, and quickly had to then divide their forces, giving the Imperials both time to regroup and tweak their defences as hordes of Orc now began to rain down. In many ways, for them, this was still a nightmare scenario. The Fabricator General was all too aware that their forces were now hanging by a thread, and the prospect of facing two Xenos invasion forces that greatly outnumbered them was not something that they had been praying for. However, the situation was playing out unexpectedly. The Orcs and Tyranids apparently saw each other as the far more significant threat, and were now considerably occupied fighting with one another. This was of course little more than the eye of the storm for the Imperials, because soon the fighting became even more severe than it was before, and the defences of the Imperials had to hold out against different Xenos using different tactics and weaponry. The Fabricator General was quickly coming to the conclusion that this was a battle that couldn't be won, and that they entertained the prospect of preparing their most valuable tech to be secured, most likely meaning transport off-world if it were possible, or to be transported to some deep location only accessible by Mechanicus at a later date. The Mechanicus of Sigma Austari would then use their heavily sealed, world-ending weaponry from a darker age to scour the world of all life, including themselves, securing something of a final data entry upon a doomed world, or an archiving of critical technology seems to be fairly the norm for Imperial planets. The Governor, Magos, Fabricator General or Noble Leader may place some data slate recording or even themselves atop a final entry point which is then transported deep below the surface of a world to remain retrievable by Imperial explorators at a later point in time. Only they will know of its location, and even when under assault by Xenos such as the Tyranids, such security measures in preparing something akin to a 41st millennium black box appear to be reliable. With the capital Forge Spire of the world threatened, the Fabricator General was now entertaining the possibility to undertake final actions such as these. The Warboss Worldkiller was devouring the Tyranids' Imperials alike by deploying vast hordes of Orcs upon the planet. The capital spire itself was being assaulted from two directions. On one side, a heavy defensive line known as the Cog Wall was barely holding. On the other, a collapsed Forge Spire had reduced combat to an infantry-only close-quarters battle of attrition through kilometres of crushed and collapsed spire. This had created something akin to a Space Hulk on the ground, with endless corridors eventually crushing into dead ends, huge open spaces teeming with alien horrors. The Imperials, including Sororitas, were doing their utmost to clear section by section through the ruins with flame, chainsword and bolter alike. But it was highly dangerous and grindingly slow. Worst of all, Orc infiltrators were enjoying about as much success as their Tyranid counterparts in the conditions of a collapsed Forge Spire superstructure. Invisible ambushes of any faction involved in this confusing and chaotic three-way slaughter were a critical risk at all times. Then there was the massive so-called Cog Wall, and this fared little better, but was under an entirely different scale of warfare, with knights and titans facing down orc gargants, which could be described as no less than a tsunami of lumbering monstrosities, albeit with their unsettling cheeky grins atop their heads as they toddled toward the Imperial line, guns blazing. Yet this would be a day that any who felt even a small percentile of doubt in the will of the Omnisire would live forever after in a permanent state of mechanical penance. Or, as those soon-saviours of Sigma Alstari might say, the God Emperor decreed all the galaxy belonged to his sons and daughters, and that the alien is an uncleanness that must be expunged. For at the height of the conflict upon the seemingly doomed Forge World, the light of the system's mandible point burst open as if it were a ray of holy light from the Emperor himself. Many vessels poured out from travelling in warp space, Imperial battleships, rogue traders, fleet vessels of the Indomitus Crusade, but all travelled in the shadow of the truly massive flagship of the Black Templars Astartes, Eternal Crusader. The fleet which followed was considerable and varied, battlecruisers, evacuation boats, barges of pilgrimage. The Templar fleet barreled towards the Forge World, rapidly smashing through the Xenos, dividing them and enabling a mass deployment of reinforcements. The fighting in the orbit of the Forge World was as intense as the surface landing zones, but the Saviors were carving out a foothold. As is so often the case, the mere arrival of the Space Marines, enough to swell the spirits of so many who were by now on the brink of total collapse. Crashing down from the skies in the form of the literal avenging angels of the Emperor, Xenos, who were ready to overrun fortifications, hesitated. And in their hesitation came their moments of death, as furious bolter rounds shredded their advancing lines, and Templar chain teeth met chitin and bone. The Black Templars continued to deploy into the heaviest fighting, throwing both the Xenos and Imperial defenders totally off guard. By the time any enemy knew what was coming at them, many lay dead, and others were either breaking in confusion or being simply bulldozed by the unstoppable juggernauts of the Emperor of Man. Strafing runs with Astartes gunships tore through Orc and Tyranid pockets amid the collapsed Spire superstructures, their heavy rounds blasting deep through the industrial wreckage. Many more were slaughtered, attempting to flee open ground and run into the structure of the Forge Spires themselves, but circling fire raptors pulped them with twin-linked Avenger bolt cannon, Hellstrike missiles, and their quad heavy bolter ball turrets. Despite all of this decimating glory raining down upon the Xenos, it enabled the Imperials to stabilise their positions and little more. The hammer of the Templars stopped the Xenos in their tracks, but for a moment. For many Imperial lines, they were still covering each other with fire to enable running retreats. The Orcs were, as always, relentless. And if anything, when Orcs in such vast numbers as were still continually raining down upon Sigma Alstari, see Space Marines, it only hypes them into a greater fury. And so the Imperials now faced a new wave of green monstrosities, charging them in numbers. Squiggoths, walkers, and more boys than they likely had ammunition for. Despite their best efforts, the Cog Wall was breached. The tide of green washed over and through the Mechanicus line. Broken Imperial communications from the battle lines reported weapons never seen before. Many officers were cut off reporting in mid-sentence. Others to the sound of disturbing roars and a lot of stomping. Warbus Worldkiller had something no one had expected, but was enduringly orky. So-called Orchiosauruses, even larger than the already massive Squiggoths, but also sporting explosive battering rams. Of course, the intention of the orcs was clear: access the core Forge Spire by any means necessary. Alpha Primeros would fall to the Orcs, or they would literally die trying. All attempts by Imperials both ground and air had been unsuccessful, and even Marshal Helbrecht of the Templars was looking down at the situation with increasingly furious consternation. The gargantuan Xenos monsters were lumbering with steady progress toward their goal of breaching the Forge Spire, and this must not be allowed to occur. Marshal Helbrecht took up a typical Templar approach of total, blunt extermination. Templars aboard dropships fell upon the Orchiosaurus' mounted platforms, where many Orc boys were laying down fire to the ground and air. Some Templars, despite their renowned abilities, were bludgeoned and butchered into quivering piles of flesh and bone as soon as they dropped in among the greenskins. The sheer ferocity and hyped rage joy of the Orcs fueling them to overpower even the hallowed Astartes of the Templars. Helbrecht, of course, had no sights other than that of the Orcs' war boss, World Killer. He rode atop the carriage of naturally the most grand and massive Orchiosaurus, a multi-tier carriage, sitting atop the monster, brimming with raging, shouting, gigantic Orc boys. The battle to board and fight through the entourage of World Killer was as intense as one could envision a battle with Xenos to be. No room to maneuver, no space for individual fighting styles. The Marshal and his sword brethren could only overcome the Xenos through sheer gritted teeth and brute force. Screaming their hymns and battle prayers, they battered the Orcs into submission. Not without paying a price themselves, but only through repeated and continual bludgeoning of the Orcs did they make any progress. Limbs, viscera and blood were flying, heads separating from bodies, and the Orchiosauruses below were like a waterfall of Xenos and human blood spilling down upon them. When the High Marshal finally came face to face with the World Killer, it was nothing like any of the Orcs they had faced. This gigantic Orc seemed to have unlimited power. Swinging an axe as large as Helbrecht himself, every blow shook through to the core of the legendary Astartes of the Black Templars. So powerful were its blows that it even dealt significant injury to the Marshal. One blow hit him with such force it shattered the transhuman bones in his arm, punches raining down upon him like a wild thing. His skull broke in several places as well. But the raw fury and power of World Killer eventually opened an opportunity for the clarity and vision granted Helbrecht by the Emperor, and in that moment he opened fire as the giant Orc rose up to land an execution blow upon the High Marshal. Instead, his rounds tore through World Killer's knees, bone and sinew shredding. As it collapsed down without any hesitation or even thought, Helbrecht slammed his sword through the giant Orc's head. The Orc Destroyer of Worlds was slain. As the Templars looked across the battlefield as far as could be seen, Squiggoths and Orchiosauruses were laying slaughtered. The destructive battering rams they carried would not breach the Forge Spire. The Emperor had shone favourably upon the Templars this day. Octarius had been established because of one man, Inquisitor Crypman of the Ordo Xenos. By his command, he had created the ultimate crucible of war. Two sides pitted against one another, fueled often quite literally by the losses of their enemy. Neither side able to retreat or relent, neither side able to even conceptualize how that would look or why it would happen. They would grind each other down until the only victory would be one that was total. Meanwhile, for humanity, Crypman's gamble was seen by some as the only logical choice, others as condemning multiple systems to a slow, suffocating death at the hands of Xenos. Breathless veteran fleet commands crewing every available ship they could muster and were still being chewed through and spat out by Xenos bioships. Astropaths driven into gibbering, insane shells of humans consumed by talk of desperation, death, collapse, doom and horror. The faithful doubting their beliefs, shaken to the core as they see the last god machines of the Mechanicus collapse into piles of molten slag, and stomping Orc constructs came happily tumbling through defences. Xenos worshippers pouring out of Hive City districts to consume pitifully unprepared enforcers. So many Hive cities would have been pushing their resources to more critical invasion fronts upon worlds. Meanwhile, within a Hive city, the cults of the alien deluge sectors of Hives, bringing them down from the inside until all communications fail. orders stop, and then the tsunami of alien horrors drown the brave and the strong to a terminal fate of anonymity. Refugees aboard rogue trader ships, who were more than happy to take every coin they were able to secure from desperate citizens and nobles, tell of worlds entirely ruined, hive cities ablaze visible from orbit, billions dead, ecosystems collapsed, resources devoured. Worse still, amid all the Xenos horror, some escaping the nightmare death throes of Imperial worlds tell of strange, monolithic ships arriving in planet systems. Rogue traders pieced together the puzzle from scattered reports. The Necrontyr were here in Octarius. The Orc Empire within Octarius existed, of course, long before Krypman and his plan came to fruition. Octaria itself, home to the mythical Orc known only as the Overfiend. Now, it's important to understand that this is more of a title than an individual. So far, there have been several Octarian Overfiends, and so the death of one does not mean the collapse of the Orc Empire within Octarius, but it does likely weaken their coordination, at least for a time. For the Orcs within Octarius, the Tyranid invasion has been nothing more than a jolly good time. Where others would see despair and terror, Orcs enjoy everything about their grinding war against the alien horrors. And after all, who wouldn't? It's an opportunity to crawl through organic ducts and tear apart bioships from the inside out. When your massive racer track collapses from alien forms tunneling underneath you, tunneling horrors we might say, well, it just makes your track for racing a bit more of a challenge, don't it? The Orcs were more than happy to keep the fight going against the Tyranid wherever they found them, and the more insane and chaotic, the better. Some Orcs even mistakenly attempted to tame Tyranid forms to add to their collection of beasts, with inevitably bad consequences, usually missing limbs. While Octarius was consumed with war in many pocket systems, with war bosses and Tyranid fleets grappling for control, the wider war was being fought between whatever current Overfiend had emerged for the Orcs, and for the Tyranids, their swarm lord held the Synapse reins. Across innumerable worlds, the very ground itself was turning to a viscous sludge, as billions of Orc and Tyranid forms were crushed and slaughtered by one another. The ground itself pounded into a paste of organic material, and still the fighting continued. Octarius had become the mortar within which the Xenos found themselves. The seemingly endless war of attrition itself was the pestle. And then, the Great Rift came, the Cicatrix Maledictum. In cross-referencing the most recent stellar cartography of the Imperium, the Great Rift itself has not torn through the realm of Octarius. However, it is in close proximity to areas which have been affected, and so it would be then further embroiled with conflict when the forces of Chaos arrived as a result of the cataclysmic tear of the Great Rift that's cut the galaxy in half. The scent of the slaughter from Octarius caught in the mighty nostrils of Khorne, and the blood worshippers descended upon Octarius. For the Orcs, a lovely new scrap to be had. For the Tyranids, this was yet another screeching, screaming aggravation to their goals of biomass accumulation. They wailed as blood letters washed over massive bio-titans, steadily then hacking them to pieces from the outside in or the inside out, their blades carving through them like a fish on a chopping block. Quivering Tyranid forms lay scattered about, segmented amid a soup of alien blood. Human cult worshippers, although human might be a stretch, to be honest, played their part equally well on the smaller bioforms, as many thousands ran screaming against Tyranid gaunts, attacking them with little more than bare hands, ripping, tearing, and eventually dragging the Tyranids to the ground, ripping them into hunks of pulled flesh and viscera. It was a sight rarely seen of unarmed humans charging against alien horrors with seemingly no sense of self-preservation, because, of course, they had none, their minds long lost to the void of the warp and their god of blood. This bizarre carnival of slaughter may have turned the war itself. However, it was over so briefly and served only to turn the tides of many battles individually within Octarius. In a period of less than 12 hours, the hordes of gore-crazed worshippers had receded, and the Xenos were left to take stock, regroup, and then continue their grind. Across many planets, though, the intervention of the Blood God had turned indeed the tides of many a battle, and we might speculate that although this could have been a random occurrence as the result of the birth, essentially, of the Cicatrix Maledictum, could it also have been a more concerted effort on the part of Khorne to break the stalemate within Octarius, see one side emerge victorious, to allow one of their number to break free of the confines of Octarius and spread their brutal war out into the wider Imperial territory, and all that this implied for Khorne? More war, more bloodshed, more followers, more crazed worshippers. And the biggest benefit for Khorne would be that some theatres of war, which had become stagnated, would now be reinvigorated and allow for further Xenos progression. One of the core reasons as to why Octarius had become this endless cycle of slaughter was that for as much as the smaller forms were endlessly recycled, the same could be said for those at the command level. The idea that you can just cut off the head of a senior commander, thereby leaving either side in disarray, was only somewhat accurate. As noted, there have been multiple Overfiends to lead the Orcs, and similarly, the Tyranid Swarmlord exists only until it's necessary for another to be hatched somewhere on a bioship. This is the great strength of the Orcs and the Tyranids alike. Any attempts to crush them at a normal battlefield level just lead to further and further waves coming upon an Imperial force. More carefully planned surgical attempts to decapitate leadership, if you wish to define it as such, usually only leads to a temporary lull in cohesion until their next Overfiend or Swarmlord emerges. Now, granted, for the Imperium, this may often actually be enough to then make a decisive crushing blow to a Xenos campaign, but nonetheless, it gives them tremendous staying power and more unity than many an Imperial army might. So as a result of this chaos incursion, when it came to pass that the current Overfiend was targeted by the current Swarmlord, a fairly, we might say, default battle ensued between the two. Punches were thrown, slashing, whirling, evading, fakeouts made, all the usual one-on-one battle fare. When it seemed the Swarmlord might have gained an upper hand, the Overfiend countered, and so the very big, very long fight continued. Ultimately, the Overfiend emerged the victor, crushing the Swarmlord's head in a massive power claw before tearing the Swarmlord's body in two. Yet somewhere in Octarius, the synaptic or perhaps psychic shock that had rippled out from such an event triggered a pulse of synapse somewhere deep within a vast Tyranid bioship. Cells were generated, DNA injected, and after a time, a massive sack was spewed forth, the creature inside tearing free with a bursting wave of amniotic fluid. A new Swarmlord stood ready to lead the Tyranids of Octarius. In its mind, its goal was clear: to destroy the Overfiend. When it comes to the Tyranids, one of their most well-known traits is, of course, their adaptability. They can evolve in near real time to threats and enemies and find solutions to gain an ultimate and fatal advantage. Their ability to develop new bioforms to suit whatever threat they're facing, often these changes can be fairly subtle. It's often commented on, for example, why do Tyranids not create many new forms, bigger, stronger, able to withstand any and all fire? Surely by now, they should have been able to develop thick carapace, able to withstand all but the most accurate or powerful bolter fire, for example. The reasons as to why they do not are unclear, if not unknown. Often their smaller horde forms that rely on vast numbers seem to change little, if at all. It may well be that it's simply down to a calculated level of efficiency, as the Tyranids are always seeking net gains in terms of biomass. Perhaps the development of and testing new forms makes their calculations of energy and biomass expenditure unbalanced. Who knows the specific reasons why? What you do tend to see more often are these smaller adjustments to their forms. For example, tolerance to environmental conditions or world features such as a toxic ocean, colour and camouflage, perhaps stronger jaws or claw to deal with, say, tunnelling on a planet where its defenders rely on natural geographic features. You get the idea. The point is that for the Tyranids, they have formed their primary bioforms over many thousands of years, possibly longer. And so the most commonly seen forms as recorded by the Imperium are likely pure distillations that balance biomass against lethal efficiency. However, in waging the war against orcs in Octarius, they regularly found their perfectly distilled organic killing machines were very often lacking. It was not that they were incapable, merely unable to adequately overcome their enemy, partly due to the fact that many of the orcs spread throughout Octarius fought in very different ways, or were supported by very specific factors related to the worlds they defended or assaulted. The newly emerged Swarm Lord would begin to focus in on these details where previous Swarm Lords had not. It understood through the failures of the previous Swarm Lords that if they were to overcome these green beasts, they needed to tailor their bioforms to these specific requirements. A blanket default Tyranid swarming of the Octarius region had been so far only moderately efficient, but too much biomass was being lost. Orcs, by comparison, do tend to rely singularly on their pure instincts to get them through. It's similar to the Tyranids, but different. The Tyranid is a lifeform equally driven by its genetic instinct, but it also has the power of a controlling synapse, a hive mind that allows a more coherent, wider plan to be formulated. Orcs have almost the opposite of this. They rely on something more akin to murmurations or herd reaction. This is when each individual of the mass reacts based on the movements of those in close proximity to it. Beyond these two differences, the Orcs and Tyranids are incredibly similar. They both rely on weight of numbers and extreme violence to overwhelm an enemy. They're both very adaptive and find ways around problems that might bog down other beings of the galaxy. Orcs are also not concerned with the larger problems such as ideology or material possession for the most part, although some of their kind do lean in this way, and everybody of course has their favourite shooter and chopper, don't they? But this similarity was of course one of the reasons why Inquisitor Crippman saw in the Tyranids and Orcs the perfect solution. Two forces who could regenerate rapidly and were equally as aggressive, who were driven far more by instinct and reaction than careful strategic planning. However, there was always the danger that eventually one or two of these juggernauts would identify some means by which to overcome the other, or that the war would just grow and grow until it spilled out beyond Octarius. Hence, Inquisitors like Sahansun, who sought to try and contain the spiralling conflict. The Orcs could, for example, have been blessed somehow by a creation of an ultimate weapon, or some kind of bash-together invention that just gave them power over the most alien of aliens. Something like their attack moons with the terrifying gravity whips. For Octarius, the Tyranids appeared to change their approach with the emergence of this new Swarm Lord. Orc bosses who had shown preferences for, say, hunting down special Tyranid forms, suddenly discovered their very own white whale, as it were. Although in the case of the Tyranids, this was a fluorescent blue giant bioform, or the blue one, as Orc boss Bad Squig called it. He and his boys met their demise when they finally cornered the big blue boy, only to discover that yes, it's a trap. Tyranids swarmed in and consumed them all. Elsewhere on the planetoid known as Gork's Bonce, despite the creativity and unrelenting fighting of the Orcs with the use of their traps, ambushes, gravity weapons and more, in the end they were trapped within a planetoid that the Tyranids simply overwhelmed with sheer weight of numbers and eventually pulped them into full extermination. The emergence of the Swarm Lord saw a depressing trend for the Orcs. Their racing tunnels became clogged. Trapped lads having a lovely shooty racy time were annihilated. Production centres and Orc shipyards were deluged with vast eel-like void-swimming forms who clamped onto Orc constructions and industrial centres, either chewing through them with crushing teeth or vomiting out acids and bioforms that swept through them like liquid under pressure, or in some instances, both. Where the Tyranid horrors had once been typically aggressive, attempting to deluge their foe, the failure of their standard approach overall had given more methodical rise to tactics or tailored adaptation, and now were engaging their enemy with something more akin to careful, designed planning by the aliens. The Swarm Lord felt the burning desire, of course, to destroy the Orcs' Overfiend. Their fleets of bioships had closed in around Octaria itself. Walls of chitin, bioplasma and acid halted Orc reinforcements who would break up upon them attempting to reach Octaria, leaving only their shredded remains. The Swarm Lord's final play was now in sight. Yet there are few who have seen the true insanity of a world or planetoid which has come under the full extended control of Orcs. This is because largely Orcs tend to be fairly mobile. They move from one place to another seeking the next big fight, or they travel in fleets on a permanent war kick, or perhaps they're just so busy fighting with each other nothing really gets done. Most of the time, though, they're basically on a big galactic fighty pub crawl. The point being, while orcs who invade a world have big mechs, zogging big machines for racing, shooting and stomping, plus their various monstrous creatures that they adapt for their war needs, a world consumed entirely by orcs is really something else to behold, although in part it does of course also depend on the resources available. If we cast our minds far back to the beginning of the orcs coming to Octarius, they had discovered here any number of imperial worlds with vast amounts of scrap to be consumed, so that by the time the Tyranids arrived on Octaria, orc mechs had turned entire geographic regions into machines of death. Mountain ranges themselves opened like jaws and chomped down on delicious Tyranid spores and descending forms. Entire orc cities were able to get up and move themselves around. The very terrain itself would rise up and alter, shifting the balance of power the Tyranids thought they had in deployment. Well-covered areas became flat, open killing fields. Areas of easy advance became horrific choke points of slaughter. Tyranid losses assaulting Octaria were initially painful and significant. If this had not been part of the carefully laid Swarmlord plan, it might have failed at this initial wave, but there were many Tyranid reserves held back, and they too would descend upon Octaria. While some Tyranid forms assaulting a world will inevitably be disintegrated or vaporized by the powerful weapons of M41, another thing worth remembering is that when Tyranids assault a world, their general advantage is that they can absorb the absolutely massive losses that such a strategy requires. They will quite literally deluge their enemy and choke them to death before grinding all that remains into a fine paste for processing. All the dead and destroyed Tyranid forms are also swept up and recycled. So the majority of Tyranid conflicts end up with a significant net gain in biomass for the Tyranids, thus affording them ever more strength to assault the next world. So while this new Swarmlord had indeed taken a more methodical approach to the orcs, tailoring some engagements to enable a specific and efficient outcome, when they deployed their final assault upon Octaria, it was a very typically Tyranid assault. Control the space around the world, control its orbit, control its atmosphere, control its surface, and then slaughter all who remain. Bioships around Octaria continued to arrive, and it was becoming clear with no reinforcements, no matter how creative the orcs had been, it would take an intervention by Gork or Mork themselves to turn the tide of things now. Bile acid rained down in torrential levels upon the mountains and shifting geology of the planet. Consumption of the planet itself began early as a means of mitigating the attrition of heavy losses being felt by the Tyranids. Regaining biomass was required to enable the Tyranid victory here on one of the most heavily fortified and populated orc worlds of the entire Octarius realm. In the purest sense, the Great Devourer had reached the heart of Octarius, and it sought nothing less than the total consumption of the Octarian Empire. Its goal was to break free of this entanglement it had found itself in, this web spun unknown to them by a lone Imperial Inquisitor. The greatest danger, though, still remaining for the Swarmlord was that in committing so heavily to this one region of Octarius, other Orc warbosses might gain ground and even emerge as a new overfiend, even as this one looked ever closer to its own demise. By now the Orcs were taking truly heroic losses, the sheer volume of Tyranid forms upon the world so great that the Orcs were engaging them with nearly continuous levels of fire. Guns only ceased firing when barrels either shattered from heat or ammunition ran dry, axes and choppers discarded only as they were blunted, and Orc mechs were trapped amid ruins and the dead as more agile Tyranid forms stepped over or leaped over them, piercing their shells with vicious claws and spiked legs, tearing them apart and filling them to overflowing with acids and devouring smaller creatures who ate whatever lay within the orc constructions. The orcs of Octaria were steadily being withered down, and despite the overfiend fighting an unrelenting battle against the alien horrors, even he would eventually give but a merest moment of weakness, for a Carnifex in its death throes would lash out and carve a notch through his leg so severe it was enough for the Swarmlord to sense and seize the moment. When it descended to the planet, it did so with hundreds of its tyrant guards, and together they would fight the Overfiend and his own personal guard. Yet after such continual pressure from lesser forms, even the Overfiend was not immune to momentary exposure, and in doing so the Swarmlord would sever the hydraulics to one of his immense power claws. Weighed down now by his own powerful tech, the Tyranid Lord would move in now with instinctive grace and clarity to bring down its bone swords upon the head of the Orc Overfiend, cracking its head and skull cleanly open. Within moments, the Tyranid Lord came down upon the Overfiend with its jaws, feasting on the goo within. One of the most interesting aspects of Octarius has been, of course, Inquisitor Crypman. It appeared that Crypman's role as the one who orchestrated the Octarius War by luring the Tyranids into direct conflict with the Orcs, but also through his extreme use of Exterminatus to attempt to protect the wider Imperium, had sealed his fate as an Inquisitor, and that other Inquisitors had taken the rare step of declaring him then excommunicated and under a death penalty. However, as is often the case, while the wider Inquisition may declare such a judgment, finding an Inquisitor to execute such an order is another matter entirely. Also worth remembering that when you have an empire as massive as the Imperium, Inquisitors in one area declaring something does not mean such a judgment would be necessarily disseminated down through to those representing the interests of, say, Inquisitor Crypman. So through both Rising Tide and Critical Mass, we've seen how Inquisitor Crypman is still very active in receiving information from his informants and operatives throughout Octarius. There are several agents named throughout the series, and it's clear that they're working for Cryptman. In one instance, it describes how survey skulls are monitoring across various Xenos battlescapes, and the display screens are marked with the letters F and K, with an Inquisitional sigil as well. Of course referring to Fidus Crypman. The more prominent member of Crypman's inquisitorial retinue is known as JBZ, who is steadily in contact with him throughout the series. These essentially serve to flesh out additional small details of the conflict, but they're fairly superficial and simply add to the backdrop. So instead, the more interesting aspect to this is how it embeds Inquisitor Crypman as still active in relation to the Octarius situation, which is fairly unexpected. I think when this Octarius development came about, it was fairly expected that Crypman's part in the situation after him being basically kicked out of the Inquisition was done and done. However, throughout the Octarius War, it also appears that he has been doing little more than being fed information about the progression of the situation and what other Inquisitors themselves have been doing. The format of reports to Crypman, though, do help us to summarize the situation at the closing stages of what information we currently have available for Octarius. Inquisitor Sahansun has essentially managed to hold the cordon currently, but this is precarious. Planets that are along the cordon are either underprepared or mass conscripting citizenry, which in itself is destabilizing worlds. Most critically, we learn through communications to Crypman that Inquisitor Sahansun is even sending communications to request an audience with Robert Gulliman to impress upon him the severity of the situation here. Worth noting that this is certainly justified given that already multiple Primaris Marine chapters have been thrown into the grinder of Octarius and, of course, the Black Templars. Numerous Imperial Guard, Knight Houses, Sororitas, Titans and the like, and still things sit on a knife edge, so if that's not worth Gulliman's attention, I don't know what is. More interestingly though, Crypman's servants here make reference to Tiamat. This small seed planted within the large descriptions of conflict in Octarius is a blink and miss it detail, but the inclusion of reference to Tiamat is very intriguing. What is noted is that stormtroopers of Imperial Guard somehow captured a Drakari homunculi, and that it is believed they may be able to extract information from it. Now, homunculi are functionally immortal, and have existed since, it is believed, the fall of the Eldar. In fact, it's very possible that they are among some of the first to have lured others into the dark spiral of the pleasure cults that created Slaanesh. Now, why the inquisitorial agent of Crypman believes such a being could aid in the problem of Tiamat specifically is unknown. Perhaps merely their vast knowledge or memory? And also, what is Tiamat, you might ask? Well, Tiamat is a system on the eastern fringe of the galaxy, and it is believed to have been seeded with Tyranid spores long before the Tyranids in fact began encroaching upon the galaxy proper. Explorators in M35 discovered that the system was basically all death worlds before it was consumed and contaminated. Eldar rangers also visited the system later and discovered a bizarre continent-spanning organic conical structure formed of chitin and soft encephalic flesh, pulsing with unmeasurable levels of psychic energy. The shadow in the warp was horrifically strong around Tiamat, and even more so in proximity to this construct, unseen on any other world or location where the Tyranids have been found since, because usually Tyranids just scour planets of biomass. Within the Tiamat system, they did not do so, and the high fleet known as Tiamat, but now shrouded behind Fleet Kraken, have for some reason claimed this system as permanent territory, very likely to protect this strange construct. And it has been subsequently seen to destroy the minds of Astartes librarians. Several of the Eldar rangers who visited suffered terminal convulsions upon venturing near the structure, their minds sent into a state of irreversible shock by the sheer force of Tiamat's aura. The Ordo Xenos and Kripman later became aware of this and have speculated that this Tiamat construct may be in fact a beacon for other Tyranid fleets to approach the galaxy, and for that reason, Tiamat is a point of concern, significant concern, for the Ordo Xenos. So, the point being, it is certainly very interesting to me that in the aftermath of final communications of Octarius, this was a point that was worth mentioning. In one sense, it can be seen as merely some offhand lore comment, but in another, it seems very specific to include if you don't intend to later follow it up. So, we will wait to see the outcome of that. Another detail of interest is the ultimate fate of the Orc Crown device. We remember the failure of Inquisitor Van Roth and his hope that this strange machine may have been the ultimate weapon against the Tyranid. Its fate also unknown due to the disastrous end to Van Roth's mission. Some Imperials may have fled the world, but ultimately it's a big question mark. So the structure of communication with Kripman remains intact. What was most interesting was that despite everything which has occurred, it was made clear that Kripman and his agents want to make contact even with the Imperium, to make them aware of the fact that the Tyranids have now gained a significant advantage for at least the time being. It's unclear if even a new Overfiend emerges within the Orcs, as has happened previously, would it be enough to drag the Tyranids back into a state of stagnant attrition? Possibly not. It was the assessment of Kripman's agents that now, with their vast accumulation of biomass from multiple victories, the Tyranids may now have gained so much figurative momentum, there may be in fact nothing left to stop them. It's simply a matter of time for them to consume the rest of the Octarian sector before they emerge hungry for more. And this is very clearly a significant problem for the Imperium now, as if they don't have enough significant problems. While the Cordon Impenetra had held, and while the Forge Worlds held out, infighting and disorder appeared to be rife within the borders of the Imperium that they're so desperately trying to reinforce. It seems honestly a chaotic mess, and it's unclear just how on earth they're going to defend against this now far more powerful Tyranid force. Right now, they have far from what is required, not to mention it's a large question mark if the Imperium even has the resources to spare currently to contain Octarius. If the Tyranids continue their rampage unchallenged, the answer to that is very clearly no. So finally today, something to try and bring this together, a conclusion and assessment from me. Octarius delivered to us two supplementary books, Rising Tide and Critical Mass. However, the recently updated Kill Team was also launched to the background of Octarius. You'll remember that the launch gave us animations of Krieg guardsmen battling orcs amid industrial superstructures. Many suspected that this was going to be a full-fledged launch of a new Krieg force. That hasn't happened yet. We also felt that there might have been larger tales to tell, that this Octarius situation may have gone on and on. I think it's fair to say that as with anything in 40k, that is still of course possible. Very often elements of lore within 40k are put on hold and then circled back around to later to connect dots and of course enable new miniature releases. So I partly wonder if and when the Imperial Guard Codex and inevitable new models come, will there be a tie-in there for Krieg and Octarius? It felt like we really only scratched the surface with Octarius before suddenly it came to an end. And I've spoken before about what I think material like this really requires, so I won't repeat myself, but the short version is a lot more than was delivered to us here. We've had various elements of the Inquisition arranging their plans, and this is left in degrees of resolution. We have Kripman clearly still with a vested interest in what's happening within Octarius, and he's being actively communicated with, which is fine. But beyond the literal observance of such details, what's that all about? Where's the resolution there? It's unclear why it needs to be Crypman who facilitates this conveyance of information about Octarius when you have Inquisitor Sahansun already, perhaps because Crypman is the only one with the vision and conviction to understand the true threat and what actions need to be taken. Perhaps this is setting up Crypman's return to the Imperium, although considering his crimes against humanity so far, this seems unthinkable for both the Imperium and Inquisition. So it's unclear how that will line up, and it's unclear if and when we might find out more about it at all. It somewhat feels like these supplements were more establishing than anything else, but then similarly the Psychic Awakening series did the same. By the time various events related to the Cicatrix Maledictum and the Pariah Nexus were detailed, it was barely enough to whet appetites. That's all that we were granted, and some of that was fairly contradictory. Octarius has felt the same, coupled with the fact that some narrative related to Ghazghor Thraka has now altered. I think in honesty this comes back to something I and others have discussed for a while, that supplements need to be far more focused on providing lore and background than any additional rules or campaign elements, for the benefit of both. It needs to be more in the split of 70% lore, 30% tabletop, not the 50-50, 40-60 it often feels like currently. It would benefit both situations to improve things, give more lore in background books, and keep more tabletop in the codexes. I think if you were to look back also at things like the Forge World Heresy books or Imperial Armor, this is what supplements should be aiming for. They are in essence lore coffee table books, or for people like me, delicious archives to pore over and immerse yourself in. Now, do I think things are heading that way right now? Not necessarily. For now though, I think some of the deeper analysis related to campaigns will have to wait for another day, but as I've said before, it can't just be rage dismissed nor scoffed at either, because campaign supplements are genuinely vehicles to flesh out adjacent and extended areas of the 40k verse which just wouldn't happen otherwise. And as I've noted before, Gathering Storm was something people were very dismissive of at the time, but has now become truly embedded in the verse of 40k. So I would still rather have supplements than not, because otherwise you'd be left with simply generic codex detailing backgrounds, which is often kept largely the same across many years of releases, albeit with small elements changed. You'd have to hope you were going to be able to find those slivers of detail, those 2 to 3 paragraphs of visionary revelation amid tome-length novels that grant you new information about the evolving 40k verse or context to its established characters. So even if supplements are more of a summarization than the details that you get in a novel, I'll definitely take that, because as I've said before also, this is sometimes preferable. It moves things forward and it gives us a broader vision. So, do I still want supplements to be heavily immersive supplementary tomes that are absurdly and unnecessarily detailed? You better believe I do. But until then, I'll take it as it comes. What's unclear to us is, will this be the last we hear from Octarius? In my general cross-referencing and searching, there seems to be a general consensus that Octarius is now a done deal, signed, sealed, delivered. This really was not my assessment, because while it's true that the Tyranids have secured a major victory in Octarius and seemingly overwhelmed the Orcs at every opportunity, they have not yet begun to leave Octarius. In fact, they may still have a considerable Orc presence to deal with, one that might take them many, many years, which critically buys the Imperium valuable breathing space that we might see more story progression in. For example, careful lengths were made to lay out the fact that the cordon so far has held, albeit in a very fractured and high-pressured situation. Yet Inquisitor Sahansun may wish to speak to Gilliman. Crypman may want to connect with the Imperium. What will happen there? Then we have the other factions that are still somewhat involved. Chaos, Eldar, even a scant mention of the Necron. So this surely can't be the end. The Eldar have seemingly grown ever closer to the Imperium in recent times. Might this be another situation where to allow High Fleet Leviathan an uncontrolled success in Octarius would be too big to go unchallenged? As always, time will tell, but I'm genuinely interested in your thoughts out there. From your own Hive City sectors, tell me, instead of devouring that last tempting cube of corpse starch, put down below your thoughts about the state of Octarius and the end of this current reporting. Because quite critically, the final thing to note is that in communicating with Inquisitor Crypman, his seemingly core agent noted specifically that by the time these detailed assessments were sent through to Crypman, they would be, quote, out of date, to a point of worthlessness, which to me suggests there's still everything to play for. So let's now talk about my next selection for Audible. Today's recommendation is Bloodlines. As noted at the beginning of this video, I have been significantly enjoying taking a refreshing step away to look at the more detailed underbelly of the 40k verse through the lens of the Warhammer crime series. Now for some, these narratives are not always what people expect them to be, given the standard fare of 40k narrative. This is largely because when you're dealing with a crime story, and more specifically on the world of Alecto inside Hive Varangantua, it's a Hive city that is more closed off and in some ways sheltered compared with other Imperial planets. This in turn can leave the stories of the Warhammer crime feeling considerably more noir and less of the galactic space horror opera that we see in the more mainstream 40k narratives, if you want to phrase it that way. However, this is specifically why I have enjoyed the crime series so far, and especially the audiobooks. They are a refreshing gear change, as I keep saying, in how we see the world of 40k, and moreover, they deal with the dystopian daily lives of the ordinary citizens who are at one level of scale barely seen, heard, or missed when their planet is scoured from existence, yet at the scale of Warhammer crime, their every action and personal journey has a powerful human significance. Bloodlines pulls us into an investigation of a wealthy family, where our probator is tasked with locating a missing scion of said family. He knows his efforts to be largely futile, but he grinds on as his role requires. Any investigation within the lower levels of a Hive city is far from being a safe occupation. There are many who do not wish to have the rock lifted from atop their operations. And of course, as the probator digs ever deeper, he discovers unpleasant realities that have been kept hidden by powerful hands. It might be a little strong to say this is something straddling Blade Runner meets Dread and flavors of Sin City, but it's not far off. I sincerely hope we continue to get a regular fare of well-crafted Warhammer crime, as it's just about my favourite 40k genre right now. So as a final reminder, if you're new to all of this, you can start listening today with a free 30-day Audible trial, get you full access to thousands of audiobooks, originals and podcasts included in the Plus catalogue. Visit audible.com/lutin or text lutin to 500 500. Thanks for your support, as always, and I'll see you all in the next one.